The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Catherine Pompilio with an episode of Live from Ukraine for July 17th, 2022. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Live from Ukraine, an experimental podcast hosted by Benjamin Wittes that spotlights Ukrainian voices amid Russia's invasion of the country. Today's Live from Ukraine episode features a conversation with Katya Savchenko, a Ukrainian woman who survived several days of the brutal and murderous Russian occupation of Bucha. In the episode, Savchenko spoke with Wittes about her experience at Bucha and her decision to write and share a diary she wrote while in a bomb shelter as Russian forces closed in and attacked. This is Live from Ukraine.
This is Live from Ukraine, a conversation with Ukrainian voices taped live on Twitter Spaces. To join future audiences, follow me at Benjamin Wittes. Our guest today is Katya Savchenko, who wrote recently an extraordinary diary on Medium of 7 or 8 days surviving in Bucha under the Russian invasion and then presence. And I asked her to join us on the show to talk about the diary, to talk about what happened in Bucha. So Katya, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for sharing this important topic with your audience.
So I want to start 8 years before Bucha, because this was not the front you had to flee a Russian invasion. And when I first read that you had first been displaced in the first Donbas conflict in 2014, it sounded like a little bit to me like there's a joke in English, fleeing Hiroshima for Nagasaki, and this, you know, like, you know, being driven out of the Donbas to go to Bucha is, it's a kind of almost unimaginable parade of horrible. So let's start in 2014. Where are you and your family from, and how did you end up in Bucha in the first place?
Okay. Yes, I was born in Donetsk. Then I grew up in Gornivka. It's a city in Donbas region. In 2012, I moved to Kyiv because I studied at a university, Tarasuchenko National University of Kyiv. So during 2014, I was already in Kyiv, and that winter from like 2013 and 14, I was participating in the Maidan also. So I tried to support it as much as I could. And when everything started in Crimea, my family was already nervous about it. And my dad told us that I think that Donbas will be the next, because we always knew about this Russian appetites for the territories. So in spring, my dad came to visit me in Kyiv. So we started to search for a new place to live, maybe just in case, just to look for a new apartment. And we chose a place in Bucha. We really fell in love with that place. And it's in the forest. It's super nice town with nice people there. Yeah, we fell in love. And then when everything, like, when this, like, all this bombing started already in Donbas. My dad was already in Bucha, not in Bucha, in Kyiv, because we like bought an apartment, but we still had to do some stuff. And so we just were in the apartment of our friend in Kyiv, and my dad was already in Kyiv, but my mom and sister, they were in Kharkiv at the time, and then they had to pack their stuff as fast as they can and just took the first train and go to Kyiv. And the first months we were staying in that apartment in Kyiv, and then we moved to Bucha finally. And what is the most the most sad thing for me about the situation is that when I was at home the last time, it was 2014, it was I went home to see my relatives on Easter. I didn't know that this is my last time at home, because then I just didn't have any chance to go back, because it was already occupied by that time when I was in Kyiv.
When the war started, the full-scale invasion, did you think it was coming to Bucha, or you thought of Bucha as a safe place to be? What was the, it's obviously far from Donbas, but did you have a sense that you were likely to be, sort of right in the path of the Russian assault on Kyiv?
I can say that our family was thinking that the first thing that we really believe that it can be possible, and we really was thinking about that it's going to be not only the east of Ukraine. I don't know, maybe that was just experience or something like that. So 1 month before the full scale invasion, we met with our family, and we were trying to decide what we're going to do if everything will start. But we didn't think about that support from Belarusian side, that Belarus will support Russia, and that from their territories also will be some provocations and attacks, and the forces will be going from that part. So our dad was sure that it's the best option is to be together and to be in one place, because we were thinking about that maybe they will try to cut off their connections, mobile, like internet or something like that. And we just tried to see what we're going to do, and our decision was to, if everything will start, so we just grab our stuff, everything we had, in our rooms, because I was living in Kyiv by the time, and my sister also, but our parents were living in Bucha. And at the first chance, we have to go to Bucha, so we can meet all together. And we, didn't think that it will be even worse to be in there than to be in Kyiv. Of course, no one knew, I guess. And that's why I had my backpack prepared approximately week before the 24th of February. Yeah, and when I woke up, we just even didn't discuss what we're going to do, because we already had this plan that we have to go to Bucha. Of course, I had some hope that our parents will decide to go somewhere to the west, for example, I don't know, or to leave the town, because already in the day it was clearly understandable that everything started from Gostomel, which is really close to Bucha, and everything can start there in Bucha.
Just for people who don't know, Gostomel is the site of a large cargo airport. Mm-hmm. The Russians tried to take, and was the site of a very significant battle as a result.
Yeah, thanks. And but there were already huge lines, and we just understood that it's almost impossible to get out of the town. So our dad was he made this decision that we have to stay. And of course, I can understand him. He was in shock, every of us. And he didn't want to leave his home this for the second time. It was really painful for him and for my mom, because they just started their new life in Bucha. It took some time and some years for them to settle there, because we are young. For us to move to another town, it's it's a stress, but it's not as hard as for our parents because of the age. And
so you go on the first day to Bucha. One thing I'm, your the diary is remarkably detailed in some ways, but it left me with the question: when did you realize that you had basically gone exactly the wrong direction, and that, going from the the better thing would have been for your parents to come to Kyiv rather than for you to go to the house in Bucha. When did you realize that you'd sort of walked into the firing line?
I think it was exactly the first day. Like in the evening, I already understood that, okay, I understood that Bucha is not a safe place, but it was really hard to understand what's going on in other cities, because I will try to explain. When you're just in this situation, when there's like shooting arounds and explosions, you're kind of thinking that other cities are in the same situation. Like, you cannot imagine that somewhere can be really calm and nice, and of course, like, because Kyiv wasn't nice at all. And but I think that during the like late evening already, I realized that we made this wrong decision. And of course, on the next days when we started to read the news, we just understood that we are in a big risk now, and that it's better. It was better to stay in Kyiv, or even maybe to go there now. But again, our parents didn't want to go, didn't want to leave, and it was already it wasn't safe to go, because their forces were really fast, and some ways were already blocked or damaged or something. And being in shelter, it has some this I don't know even how to explain. It helped you to think that you are kind of like safe, because you have some kind of cover over your head, because going to somewhere where you do not know anything about the like the situation is even scarier. And of course, that the news they weren't able to provide you with this full information about the roads, about the transport and stuff.
So one of the most moving parts of the diary to me is where you describe sitting in the shelter and thinking about your values. And you write, and I maybe should just find the passage and read it, but you write that you're never going to again not proclaim your love for somebody when you feel it. You're not going to spend any more time regretting professional choices, or that you're, you know, where you are in life. I'm interested in whether that was a momentary feeling under a situation of enormous stress, or whether that experience of being in that shelter and not knowing that you were going to survive the next day has had a longer term impact on your outlook on the world and the way you engage with people.
Yeah, that was a really kind of powerful moment, because I was super scared at that time. That was one of the scariest day, I guess, because all these explosions and shootings were super close, and I was really like thinking that every next second can be the last one, every next minute can be the last one in my life. So yeah, the first thing I did, I just wrote my friends to the chats, because I didn't have much time. I was thinking so that I don't have much time to write everyone in person, that I wanted to apologize for everything, that I love them so much, and I don't know if I will survive. And that was a way for me maybe to calm myself down. I don't know, when you face a situation when you feel that you can die exactly the next moment, it sounds super like in movies or something like that. I never believed in that, but it really happened to me, that you can see the whole your life and you're not analyzing even it. You just see some random pictures from it, and you are at that moment. I just understood that, oh, okay, even if I would die now, I had such a great life. I didn't regret anything. I really had the best friends ever, my super parents, and I love my country so much, and that I enjoyed each task at all my jobs that I did. And if I but maybe something I can change to make it better if I will survive. Maybe I can do even better. So yeah, I promised myself that I will not be silent about my feelings to other people, especially if they're super good ones, especially if I want to say this, yes, words of love or gratitude to someone else. And that was, I don't know how even to explain, because maybe, yeah, it was because of stress, but you feel at the same super scared, you're crying, but at the same time you feel happy that you are kind of a bit proud of yourself that you spent a great journey in this on this earth, and you're grateful for it. And I'm still with this feeling, and now I think that somehow me and my family, we feel that if you already survived that experience, there is nothing in this life you can be scared about. I mean, if you're like afraid to write to someone or to ask for a job offer or something like that. So these things, they are so miserable comparing to all that experience that we had, and you have to use any chance this life gives to you. And yeah, so I don't know, maybe, yeah, I have nothing to add.
So one of the things that I was interested in the diary was that you are clearly very aware that terrible things are going on around you and outside the shelter. And you write at one point that you hear rumors that there were killings and rapes. But it's not clear to me that you were aware in real time that there was a mass slaughter, and you know, the scope of the atrocities that we've learned since the Ukrainian armed forces retook the city. And so I guess I was interested in, you know, was your sense that there was a war going on around you and that it was dangerous because there was a war? Or was your sense that there was a massacre of civilians going on, and it was dangerous because there was a war and because the Russians were wantonly killing civilians intentionally? How much did you know about what was happening outside the shelter in Bucha?
When we were in the shelter, of course, like my sister, she has more friends from Bucha because she continued her study at school there. So she was in contact with her friends, with her teachers, for example, who also were in Bucha, and some of them tried to escape. And so the first thing that was like from the just personal connects and contacts, or from people who we know, that they saw something from their windows, for example, or they even experienced that. It's like, as I said, for example, my sister's friend, they tried to went by car to a direction of Kyiv, I guess, I don't remember. And the situation that Russians stopped them, and then they checked the car, and then they told them, that, okay, you can go. But then they started to shoot at them from the back of the car. And they damaged the wheels. So she was super scared, and she just managed to continue her way just on the flat tires. And it wasn't only the one story. Like the other source, we had this territorial defense groups. Yes, these guys who were volunteers who was like observing what is going on in the town, just looking how was the situation. So they visited us for several times, and they just shared some news with us, what they saw, for example, or what they heard there. And if, for example, of course, I didn't, I just understood, I didn't have any like expectations of the kindness from the Russians, because it's war, and we always knew their attitude to us, to Ukrainians. But even I was shocked with the news when I saw this scale, because I knew somehow the situation, because again, like the stories, and we had more than 200 people in the shelter. Everyone has some relatives, some neighbors who texted them that they saw something or they heard something. And somehow we knew, but even I was shocked with when I saw the pictures, when I was already not in Bucha. I couldn't imagine that this it's so huge, that was like really, I know that streets and this the number of it's just something terrifying. And for example, the first days we could hear this, you know, this massive like explosions, really hard one, and shootings. But then after a couple of days, they changed just to automatic bursts. And when we went to the toilet, for example, sorry for the details, because like we were sitting in the basement, but the toilet was on the first floor. This shelter, like security guys told us that please don't go too close to the windows because like there are some this like shootings just from the guns. And even there were some days they told us not to go up. And we could really hear all that sound that something is going on, that's just some guns. After that, I was like, somehow me and my sister, we were really lucky. So we didn't see the corpses on our way, even when we went from Bucha to Irpin. I don't know, maybe we were just in shock and I just tried to look forward and not to like look around. But my parents, they saw them, and like that situation that happened to Vlad and just to other friends. So for us, it was clear that something super terrible is going on, not just because of the heavy weapon, but just the street fights or something like that.
It was clear to you that something terrible was going on, and yet you were still surprised when you saw the pictures and realized the scale of it.
Yes, yes. I mean, I was just remember when I saw all those pictures, I couldn't believe like my eyes. But my parents saw like some of this, like some of the like like more like close than we are, but of course. And I just remember I wrote to my friends that I don't like, I can't imagine how we can go to the town again. I can't imagine that I can just walk that streets around. And
so you make a very interesting stylistic choice in the diary, which is that you never capitalize the word Russia or Russians. And I'm interested, I assume that was from the original diary, not just a creature of the translation, but I'm interested in what that choice reflects in your own thinking.
I don't think that they deserve, you know, this like capitalizing. For me, this country, the government, they doesn't exist. I mean, they don't have to exist. I mean, in that way, of course, in that way that it exists now, like doing all these crimes against Ukraine and against other world. So just, I don't know, it's kind of emotional. I just cannot capitalize this first letter of this country. And moreover, like, sorry, just also answering your previous question, about the crimes and everything. My dad, he was under the fire also. After a few days, like after we left with my sister, my dad personally was under the fire. He was shot in the car by Russians. And so I just realized that he was just lucky enough to survive, because the driver and his wife, they were wounded. And the driver was wounded in the leg, and shrapnel from the car window hit the woman in the eye, and she's just they survived. That's okay, but they were wounded. And my dad, he just got down. He was sitting at the back seat in the car, and he just luckily he got down, because, and that was the thing that saved him, because after that he showed me the video of that car, and there were like four holes into the window on the back. When my dad, they just opened the fire on the car, and somehow
it's
he
kind of miraculous.
What?
It's kind of like a miracle that he was not killed or badly hurt.
Yes, yes. And then he had this like long negotiation with that writer, and my dad told that he even couldn't speak like Russian language normally, the guy who shot him. Like from the words of my father, he was somewhere from Buryatia or something like that. So he tried to negotiate with him, that he started to scream that we are civilians, don't shoot at us, like we're just civilians, we live here, and now you wounded people, we have to take them to the hospital, like he tried even to ask them for help, but they didn't. But they eventually he let him go, like after this 20 of this conversation, under the barrel of a machine gun. And so yeah, and then my daddy just carried that wounded people to the hospital in Bucha somehow, again on flat tires, because they damaged wheels again. And and I just understand that it was just a miracle. And that's it. And my dad just personally faced that. He was super close just to be dead. Like, and when I saw that all the pictures, and I just realized it, it could be him or my mom. It's no, like and going back to that question, like I will not even if I can show my non-respect to this government country, even by not capitalizing the first letter of their name. So I will do that.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me. And it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So we're going to go to audience questions in a moment. So if you have questions, this is a good time to request to speak. I want to ask you, you are now in Poland. Is your you describe at the end of the diary that your family is out and safe as well. Are you all together? Where? What are you doing now? And what will, at what point will you go back?
Yeah, my parents, they're already in Bucha. They went back. They escaped from Bucha, and then they spent like a couple of months just in another region. They were waiting, then they went back to Bucha. My sister already went back to Kyiv because we were here in Poland together, and I decided to stay here for a while. Like the first reason, I'm too scared to go back. Because, I still feel scared. And there is no safe place in Ukraine. The war is continuing, and we are checking the news every time. And you can just understand that, okay, you were a super lucky one that you escaped and that you survived. And I don't want to try my own luck again. I just don't ready. And the second reason was that I get a job here, and I was super happy about it because I wanted to earn money, so I have a possibility to donate this money to our Ukrainian army and just to other needs. And when I received the job offer, and I just decided to stay here because the company temporarily opened the office in Warsaw, and I'm really grateful for them. And I wanted to add that they really helped me with this publication of my diary, because they helped me with translation, with the editing, and I'm really grateful. So now I'm just here work for a tech company, a global one with Ukrainian roots, way like as a content project manager. And somehow it helps me to feel better, because without work, I was going mad. Like when you have nothing to do, you're just thinking all the time about the experience you had, about that you have a war, and this fear, it kills you. So somehow you need to distract your attention to something else. And I really do my job now also. And my parents, they're safe. I cannot say that they're like okay, because as I said before, there are no safe place in Ukraine. But I think that they feel better being at the apartment, and we are lucky one because our house wasn't damaged. Again, luckiness, I don't know how.
So building in Bucha that wasn't damaged.
No, they hit it. We live on the fourth floor. It was a fire on the second, but our neighbors were at the time in the building, so they just helped it not to go further. So somehow they saved the building from the fire, so and our apartment wasn't damaged.
Walter, the floor is yours for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Benjamin. Thank you, Katya. And Katya, thank you for sharing your experiences here with us. And I'm incredibly sorry that you had to relive through this twice in your life. Once, I believe, when you had to leave Orlivka and Donbass after it got occupied by Russians in 2014, and the second time nowadays in Bucha. I actually have a short question about Orlivka, but prior to that, according to your parents, how does it feel to kind of come back to the city, to Bucha? The trauma is in there. How does the city try to kind of deal with what happened? How does it feel to be in the city right now?
Yeah, thank you for your words and for the question. And for the first time, like when they just arrived, that was hard, of course, and they just didn't try to go out from the apartment. But my mom said that everything, like when we were there, it was winter, and like now, like she, I will try to explain what she said to me because I asked her about it. That now everything is green, and somehow she feels that nature covers that pictures. Like that now the pictures, they're different because you remember that the Bucha during the February, during the March, and now it feels a bit different. And our local is really good. They like repaired a lot of stuff. They're working on to rebuild the city. Of course, there are some damages that cannot be just fixed really fast, but for them, it's better to be at home at their own apartment. I just feel it. I even can hear it from their voices. They just not try, for now, they try not to go that streets, like or some of that places which you could see on the pictures. And about Horlivka, I know it's we never went back there in 8 years. We just left and that's it, and we didn't visit it at all. Even like some people they managed, for example, but we just didn't want, because for us, if you're crossing the border, you kind of you kind of accept that you have to pass this border, like you are going to another country or something like that. And that was the first reason. The second reason that I just didn't want to go there. The third reason is that me and my father, we were on the list of that occupiers, because during the time we were super like pro-Ukrainian, and I was participating in some activities in Gordievka supporting Ukrainian side. So that's why when they occupied the territory, like it was finalized, just some volunteers like they informed me that I'm on the list and I cannot go back there, like because like even in security reasons.
Just briefly to specify, because Russians always tell us that we have to hear the voices of people of Donbas. Well, I believe you are the exact example of the voice that has the incredible gravity. You are from Donbas, you are from Ukraine. You know what is happening in there, and you know what happens under Russian occupation in Horlivka, where you come from, and in Bucha, when you had it twice. So just, are you like, can you give us like brief impression, what does it feel to live under Russian occupation for so many years, if you're still connected with that part of your life in any way?
Frankly speaking, I wasn't like super close connected to that, because for the first, like the first reason, I wasn't able to go there. I was really happy not to live under that occupation, because I was already in Kyiv. I saw that people who seized the power there, like during the times, who tried, but it wasn't that time like totally occupied. I don't know. It's hard for me. I'm lucky one that I wasn't under the occupation. My grandparents are still there. They don't want to leave, and this is a really sad story, because they are kind of they really trust Russian propaganda, and for us it's really like sad situation, especially for my father, because it's his parents, and because yeah, it works powerfully on people. Even now, I just some people write me or leave some comments that it's not the real, like, and that what happened to Bucha is not for real, that it's all just some actors, and it's, what? It's a craziness. And
wait, pause on that point. They don't believe their son and granddaughter about what happened to you?
Yeah, we had this kind of, and this is frankly speaking, I don't really even want to talk about it more, because like for us it's super it's painful, because they even didn't trust to our dad, to us, and Because they always they grew up in Soviet Union, they always watched Russian TV, and even during these 8 years, you can transmit this to change their opinion, just to show them truth. But they are old people, don't know like what's in their heads. But maybe now they are starting to realize what's going on, but it's really hard for them now to admit it, because after all that happened, this is like a family drama.
Ev Gaumont, the floor is yours.
Thanks. Thank you very much for your very moving text. The diary is amazing. I was wondering how it came to be, like what prompted you to write it?
Thanks. I was writing it just during my stay in Bucha, just in the basement, because you don't really have a lot of things to do in the basement. And when I prepared my backpack, all that I had inside, like the road and my diary, which I usually like write some stuff into my diary, like even before the war, like for some years. It helps me a bit, but during the time it has some therapeutical effect. It was kind of therapy for me, just to fix the reality, because somehow you cannot understand that what is happening is for real and it is happening to you. And when you're just writing about it, somehow you feel that it's happening with someone else, not with you, something like that. So I just try to fix everything, the publication and the article on the Medium is not full, because like the story is much longer about every person I met there and about every stuff we did. And because you have nothing to do, you just sit for the whole day in a basement, sometimes like 3 days maybe per day. You used to go out to have a smoke break, and then you just ran back because it's like shellings and stuff. And so yeah, I did that.
And was there some stuff you didn't feel capable of writing, like stuff you censored? And like, why did you decide to keep some of this, the thing you wrote, and decide not to publish other parts?
I just realized it's a really long, long story, and it's going to be too much symbols for an article. So I wanted to edit it in a way. Just of course, when I was publishing it, the first thing I wanted to share what happened to me, and I want to be heard that what is going on with a person who just had this experience day by day. And I understood that if I'll publish the full version, it will be too long, and maybe one day I will manage to do it. I don't know, like maybe I'll try even to write a book or something just to fix that what happened to me. I don't know, like, but I just made this decision, and there were some like really personal things that I wasn't ready to share with the audience.
We have a question from I don't know what the person's name is, but the tag is Slava Ukraini, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Herem Slava. Actually, Shannon, Shannon Sashenko, thank you for your story. It's incredible. I'm so happy to hear what you had to live from. I have a question that about your relatives who don't believe what is happening in the Bucha. Do you plan maybe in the future try to how to maybe different with different approach, how to maybe change their minds? Maybe you have this any hopes, maybe it's changes, because I still hearing the stories from a lot of the people who on the east of Ukraine have relatives, and this is completely similar stories. Relatives still believes that it's within this Russian propaganda. Thank you.
You know, that's a difficult question, because we are still trying almost every day. Of course, I have some hope, and still I'm trying to believe that one day they will change their opinion. But I from the other hand, I'm trying to be realistic and preparing myself. Maybe it will never happen. They are too old now, and I cannot just. It's a really it's a difficult topic, and I think that people, the psychologists need to work with people who were under propaganda for for all this time. It's not so easy even just to explain it, because you know these arguments, it didn't work, because you have to like switch on your logic, you have to do fact checking and stuff, and not everyone is ready for that. It's much more easier just to watch TV, I don't know, and believe it. So I'm not a professional in this question. I'm trying, and we are still trying, of course, and we are telling them, but I don't know if we'll succeed.
Walter?
Yeah, I'll go slightly on a tangent here, specifically regarding 2014, if you recall those days, because the narrative that we encounter is that Ukrainians or Russian-speaking Ukrainians somewhat supported what was happening in there, or support like the movements. But I want to hear the notion or the first-hand experience from a person like you who has seen what was happening in 2014 when Russia initially invaded, when those protests were in Donetsk, and I believe those were also pro-Ukrainian protests. And there are rumors that people were like moved in from Russia to take part in that, if you recall.
Yes, for what I remember, sorry, second. As far as I remember the days, really like some like Russians were in Ukraine the days. They were just transferred there. I don't know like how. Like I remember, of course, we had the pro-Ukrainian this protest in Donbas and had to do them in Horlivka. And but this like I don't know, somehow Russia started to work there from the inside of Donbas. Like they didn't invade the territories for the first. Like they started to do it in a different way. Like from the inside, they just moved to Ukraine and just started to organize some strange movements inside. And I remember that moment when at that time I was in Gorlivka during the Easter when I went. I remember that the mayor of the city, he was took as a hostage, and the most pro-Ukrainian deputy was killed at the time. And there were some really strange and random guys who seized a power in the city. I remember I was staying in the main square in Gorlivka, and I saw this red flags, something, and I couldn't believe my eyes. And some people, they really believed in this idea of independent Donbas or something like that. But it's not. It would never happen if Russia wouldn't like do that, like there, like if Russia wouldn't use that instruments that time, so they just move some people there who were organizing that protest and something like that. Like never. I don't believe this, because we had a lot of people who supported Ukraine at the time in the Donbas, and some of them, they wasn't able to move on, for example, to another region, some territory. Because of multiple, I don't know if I answered your question, because I'm not sure. I just can say about the things that I really saw with my own eyes. I don't want to be I'm not a professional, you know. I'm not a politician, and I'm not like analyst and these things. Just can say about what I saw.
Rajnish, the floor is yours. You got to unmute yourself, sir. All right, we're going to move on. Ev, do you have other questions?
In your diary, you're talking about humor. You know, like you're saying that it's something that fans rely on. I was wondering if it's still the case nowadays, or if the mood has changed since the first few months of the war, or since the first few months after the full-scale invasion.
Can you please repeat your question, because I didn't understand.
Yeah, sorry. I would like you to talk about humor, the way Ukrainians rely on humor.
Yeah, that really helped us. You know, even despite the situation and everyone was super scared and you always hear the explosions, you are trying to be optimistic, and maybe because level of adrenaline, everyone had this enthusiasm, I don't know, like to help, to do into the joke around that now we will fight them, and other lots of jokes, because humor is almost the only thing that can help you. Even just being in a shelter, we had a lot of jokes about us being captured there in a shelter that, okay, let's just imagine that we are in a summer camp or something like that. And Ukrainians are really great in doing memes and stuff. This emotional part is really important for us. And we do believe, of course, that we will win. Like, no one doubts our victory. And because we are on the right side and we like to love our defenders so much, our country so much. And we're trying to be optimistic about everything. And these jokes, this humor, this like memes, everything, it really helps us not to be sad, because we really see all this super scary, terrible, horrible news every day, like every hour. And it's impossible to survive under this pressure. So you have somehow to distract yourself and find some reasons, I mean, I don't know, to smile. And I think that this is something about like protection of your psyche, not to go crazy. And we're trying to be positive. Like,
We're going to give Rajneesh another chance. Sir, unmute yourself and the floor is yours.
Thank you, sir. I want to say about Ukraine. Ukraine is so... I'm so worried about Ukraine. And I think Russia should stop the war because everyone knows about Ukraine, okay? But I want to say Indians are so worried about Ukraine.
Okay, do you have a question, sir?
Sir, I want to know what's the position of Ukraine is now?
I guess he's asking about the state of the war now, but I'm not sure that's a question that's best directed. If you have thoughts on it, the piece actually ends by saying the war is continuing. How are you thinking about the current state of it relative to a few weeks ago or when?
I mean, my like opinion about the situation about. Can you just, sir, please explain a bit
So when you, I mean, obviously you're not a military analyst, but when you when you look at the current fighting, do you regard it as a set of positive developments? There, the HIMARS are destroying a lot of Russian ammunition. Do you look at it as a dispiriting set of developments? The Russians have taken some territory in the Donbas. Do you regard it like, how are you thinking about the war now?
Of course, I'm not an analyst, like, and no one of us. But what I can say that I'm trying not to do any like forecasts or just our horizon of planning is. I think it's 2 weeks, it's maximum, and you are just trying to live in the moment. I think that, of course, I hope that the things will be like positively on Ukrainian side, especially with this weapon and the last news about about HIMARS. They were so super like encouraging, and really hope that it will help us to make our victory real as soon as possible, sooner than it might be. And but I try not to, like, of course, because, you know, when I just arrived to, when everything just started, we were sure that, okay, 1 week and everything will, like, we'll win and everything will be ended, like something like that. Then we were thinking that, okay, maybe like 1 month, after 1 month, everything will be finished. When I just arrived to Poland, I was sure that I will not stay here longer than four. I don't know, 1 or 2 months, but now I'm already here for 4 months. So I'm just trying not to make this forecast, even for myself, just to not, if there will be some great and positive news, I will be super happy about them. But in another way, I don't want to be disappointed or something, but I still believe that we will it will deal with that and that will win. And as I said before, it is a help of the weapon in other countries. So we are really appreciate that help. We really need it, really.
Walter, do you have an additional question?
Yeah, just briefly, something that you mentioned really kind of hit me. You're essentially in a different country with a new job, but you're still donating money that you earn in a position that you're currently are. You're still donating to armed forces. And I hear more and more people are doing that. Can you kind of build upon that? And second question, just briefly, what victory looks like specifically personally to you? Is it the Ukrainian flag over Horlivka? Is it meeting someone you left in there? Is it coming back with someone that you met and returning, or it's something else? Thank you.
Sorry about the first question, like about these donations. Please, what did you mean when you asked that about, like, is still Ukrainian donate money to Ukrainian forces?
Yes. How do you feel it? How do you feel about it? Like, is it like your personal choice? You're like, you want to uh-huh. contribute still? Just, I want to hear your personal thoughts about this.
Yes, of course, I want to be useful in a way I can be, like, in any possible way. I want to contribute to our victory. And just, I can't even imagine that I won't do it. And I think every Ukrainian thinks so. I know people who gave their last money, really, because you don't need money if you don't have your own country or something like that. So you better give your, like, your last money to Ukrainian armed forces or to the people who fight for our freedom and our lives. Then you will just keep them. And that what? What will you do with this money if you will not have anything? So we are still there. As I said before, I can't even imagine that I won't do it. And somehow I think it really helps to feel that you are useful, because not everyone can, like, I'm so frightened. Sometimes I regret that I'm not brave enough to go, for example, and to fight, to take some weapon and to defend like other girls or other guys, like from our forces and, or even other volunteers who really risk their lives every day and they really help, like physically, they do something. I'm not brave enough to do this, so at least I'm trying to donate money. Like, this is the least I can do, and just to share information what happened. And the second question was about victory. Victory for me is the first thing is the territories from 91st year, like as it was before the Russian invasion. So of course Donbas, Luhansk is a part of Ukraine, Crimea is a part of Ukraine. So I want all the Russians like leave our territories and never disturb us again. And for me, victory is also like reparation. So they will be charged for it. So they will be punished, all the people who did crimes here on our land. So they will answer for all that they did. So just freelance, this yeah, Russians punished, and like how to say that, these reparations and stuff like from their side, and free country. And but of course, like another thing what I'm thinking about is that unfortunately lots of forests and fields for a long time still will be really dangerous places because of the mines and some rockets that they left. So maybe also for victory is me, it's the cleaning of the Ukrainian territory. So I hope it will be a safe place to live, to continue life.
Martin, you get the second to last question today, because I'm going to take the last one.
Thank you, Ben. Slava Ukraini.
Here I am, Slava.
Absolutely. I joined in just after this site began. So I'm just wondering, you wrote an article, Katya? If so, is it in English so someone like myself and others can read it? And second question, I'll be very concise. What would you like me as an individual here in Canada to do to help support the people of Ukraine who are fighting against this illegal, unprovoked aggression by Russia? And I'll go down to listener and thank you, and Slava Ukraini.
Hello, Slava. Thank you. Yes, I wrote an article. It's in English. It's pinned into my Twitter page. So the last tweet, it's pinned. So there is a link to an article. Yeah, this is a translation of my diary, which I wrote during my basement days in Bucha. Yeah, so it's in English. And what I can ask to do, like, for me, like, still I hear a lot of questions and affair situations when people really do not know what is going on here. Of course, there is like some amount, there is amount of people who really like following the news, who are really in topic, who really tries to support us in any possible way. But still, there are a lot of people who doesn't believe what's going on, who doesn't know what's going on, who thinks that it's somewhere far away, like, and it doesn't have any affection on them. So what I can ask is, yeah, to share information, to share information only like from the first pages, yeah, from the newspapers, but what's going on in other, like, maybe it is towns, because right now Kherson region is occupied also by Russians, and they continue to do their crimes, like sharing information, and still our defenders, lots of them were taken as hostages, and some of them really were sentenced to death. I don't know what you can do, really. I don't know what I can do to help them. But I truly believe that this sharing information, maybe just to ask governments to help something, to do something, maybe organizing protests, donating money again, because maybe someone will hear you who will have more chances to do something, I don't know, like to change the situation. Maybe some experience or some will be qualified for some stuff to do. Yeah, share the information. Yeah, donate money to Ukrainian army, Ukrainian service. Talk to people, and maybe if you have any refugees. Yeah, and this is really important for everyone. It doesn't matter from where you are. Like, if you know any Ukrainian refugees, please try to help them in any possible way, because it's really scary to lose like everything. Maybe you can, you know, people who can make some job offers for them, or maybe you can help them with like to find them a place to live, at least temporary one, or at least just to the psychologist for them, just to speak about it, because I really know that lots of people are really suffering. It's really hard to be not. It's an awful situation when you don't want to be in another country. You want to go home, but you're still super together. And you're just feeling that you're stuck in the middle of nowhere. Thanks.
Before we let you go, I have one more question about your Twitter biography, which is, I have to say, one of the most complicated Twitter bio, you know, pack a lot of information into your Twitter bio. It's, you're a patriotic Ukrainian from the Donbass with the soul of a Kievan soul, but that your blood is Greek. And I'm interested, is that a metaphor, or is your family ethnically from Greece?
Yeah, originally the east of Ukraine, the Donbas region and Mariupol, we had a huge Greek diaspora there. And the Mariupol originally was created by Greeks. And my grandmother and my family, we are like, I am a Greek, but like half blood Greek or something. Like, so I have some like Greek roots, and lots of villages nearby Volnovakha, like lots of people in Mariupol and Bugas, for example, which my granny was from. People there were still use like Greek language, and unfortunately, lots of the of that villages were already like damaged. And what happened to Mariupol is just I still cannot believe. It just scares me, and that's why it feels even more painful, because I'm feeling that Russians not only kill Ukrainians, but they also kill this minority, like the Greeks who were living there. And that's why, like, frankly speaking, I like can't understand like the position of Greek government now. But okay, it's not the topic of the discussion. Yeah, so just somehow I'm a girl from Donbas, but with the blood and roots who moved to Kyiv then. Now I'm in Warsaw.
We are going to leave it there. Katya Savchenko, thank you so much for joining us today, for writing this very moving diary, and for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thanks for sharing. Sorry if something wasn't clear, or if I made any mistakes during my speech. I really appreciate that you invited me.
It was a fabulous conversation, and we appreciate your doing it. Thanks to you all for joining as well. As always, we will be posting this to the Live from Ukraine podcast feed. You should all rate, review, and share, because, you know, you are the only promotional vehicle we have for this. It will be up later today or early tomorrow. Please do share it and keep your eye on my Twitter feed for future episodes. I will always have them as the pinned tweet once they are scheduled. Thank you all very much. We'll see you later.
Live from Ukraine is a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. You know, the engineering, I'm doing it myself because it's Twitter Spaces, but it is produced and edited by folks at Goat Rodeo. Thanks for listening.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.